this to Senator Kelly, Senator Adams, myself, Senator Porcello. I understand there were some people standing by in Anchorage when we had to cancel Friday's meeting for SB 232 dealing with the provision of locked alcohol refrigerators and containers in hotel rooms. I think we'll do, what we'll do is take up 232 first, followed by SB 201, the special appropriation to DOT for the EIS on the naval home porting issue, followed by HB 73, technical amendments to the public employees benefit statutes, and then Milt, did you bring some stuff on 74? So, and then it followed by bringing back HB 74 on the financing of the Seward Student Service Center, which was carried forward from our last meeting where we had some questions on that. SB 232, sponsored by Senator Szymanski. Senator Szymanski, did you wish to offer testimony at this time?
I think I just passed, and I think it's pretty self-explanatory.
Okay, we do have several people standing by. I understand one person, Mr. Elander, do you have a time constraint?
It would help if I could testify first from Anchorage, sir.
Bill, please proceed.
Mr. Chair, distinguished members of the committee, my name is Bill Elander. I am the president, chief executive officer of the Anchorage Convention and Visitors Bureau. I would like to testify in support of Senate Bill number 232, in support of a law allowing properly qualified hotel operations to operate the Betty Bar amenity in the hotel room. Since my experience in the hotel business, in marketing conventions and distinguished groups to hotels, the amenities play a very important part in gaining favorable decisions to bring groups of people to a destination. Alaska has been touting the fact, and we have also been touting the fact, that we do have quality, top quality hotel accommodations and services within our communities, and that we are a viable destination, particularly for the convention trade coming in. In recent years, the amenities of guest rooms has changed from what was typically a bar of soap and a towel to what do we have now in guest rooms, with shampoos and all types of bathroom amenities, and superlative service has grown now to the minibar concept. Minibar concept is a amenity that is now beginning to be expected by many of the decision makers for the corporate association business. It would certainly be helpful if Alaska's laws were such that we could follow the lead of successful marketing hotels throughout the lower 48 and now throughout Europe and Asia to be able to offer this popular amenity. It will help our marketing and it will help our image within that or with those convention and organization decision makers to bring groups of people up here. So any help that we can get in this matter will be greatly appreciated by the industry and those people that don't market this industry. That's all I have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Elander. Questions of Mr. Elander? If not, thank you very much. Ralph Noble?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
My name is Ralph Noble. I'm the general manager of the Anchorage Hilton. What I wanted to do was testify on the basis that as manager of the Palm Beach Airport Hilton in Florida, I had an opportunity to deal with the amenity bars. We fell into the normal category that, in regards to sales, that is, wine was sold at about 3% of the consumption was wine, beer about 17%, liquor was about 14%, non-alcoholic beverages about 47.5%. That included fruit juice and soda, etc. Then snacks, roughly about 18.5%. We found that the service the guests had out of these rooms was really helpful in the sale of the guest rooms. Also, I'd like to mention that at our hotel, we have had European visitors and some from the Pacific Rim that have come into our hotel They said they were tired, but we're not a world-class hotel because we don't have these bars available. So what they do, too, like to do is come in, put on their pajamas, but they don't have to wait for room service to come up. They can open up the bar, have a snack or orange juice or whatever they want, and then not worry about anybody interrupting. And this is the way good business people work. And that's about all I have to say for this bill. I am in favor of it. Certainly urge you to help us out.
Mr. Noble, thank you very much. Questions? If not, Mr. Lowe?
Mr. Chairman, distinguished senators of Alaska, my name is Max Lowe, and I'm general manager of the Clarion Hotel Anchorage. I am, however, testifying here today on behalf of the Alaska Hotel and Motel Association. I am the current president of this statewide organization, comprised of 62 hotels, motels, and lodges throughout the state, as well as 28 allied industry members. Our membership includes virtually all of the major hotels in Alaska. It's our intention to secure approved legislation which will allow the use of mini bars and overnight guest rooms throughout the state of Alaska where liquor consumption is legal. This very desirable guest amenity is now legal in 28 states in the lower 48. In addition, this practice has been used in European and Pacific Rim lodging facilities since the early 1960s and in South America since the 1970s. Well over 200,000 guest rooms in the United States presently have mini bars installed, and it is anticipated that this number will exceed 1 million by late 1992. Industry surveys indicate that this mini bar service is the second most desirable guest amenity likely to be utilized by overnight hotel guests. It is anticipated, of course, the control of in-room mini bars would be a function of the ABC Commission of Alaska. Again, some interesting specifics on mini bar sales, and I think Mr. Noble has already alluded to this. Sale percentages that we have by item: non-alcoholic beverages, 47.5%, snacks, 18.5%, beer, 17%, liquor, 14%, and wine, 3%. I also have before me a resolution of support for mini bars in Alaska endorsed by the Alaska Visitors Association, resolution number 89-1, adopted by the ABA's Board of Directors on February 7, 1989. We also support resolution unanimously adopted by the Board of the Alaska Hotel Motel Association on October 7, 1988. I would ask that you support this bill, which will give users of overnight hotel rooms in Alaska the service they enjoy, expect, and deserve. Thank you very much for your time and attention to this matter.
Thank you, Mr. Lowe. We had a question here just to, for clarification. The tax that's paid on alcohol, is that tax all, would it already be paid on the mini bottle or on the can of beer prior to its being sold? I mean, prior to being in a hotel refrigerator?
I would think absolutely so. As with any other alcoholic beverage sold, the tax would be collected prior to the sale to the user.
Senator Kill.
Well, what happens if one of your big outfits like Hilton orders their liquor from suppliers outside? How does the state of Alaska tax that?
This is Ralph Noble. We don't order any liquor from outside the state of Alaska.
Okay, well, I understand that now, but you know what we're talking about is those little airplane bottles, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And you're saying you're going to buy them all within Alaska?
We are obligated to buy it within Alaska by state law.
Wholesale.
Okay. The other question I had was, somebody mentioned it's the second most desirable amenity, and I was wondering what the first was, and I'm guessing it's television.
Yeah. I've got it here. Let me get it for you real quick. The most frequently is cited to be used by guests is in-room safe.
In-room safe. That'd be darn.
Correct.
Mr. Schrock, are you there?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman. I'll proceed with your permission.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Patrick Schrock. I'm director of the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. And I guess after hearing the testimony you've heard already, I'll get to my last comment. I certainly don't intend that my remarks be taken in the negative. They're really only intended to pass information or raise questions with the committee related to the bill that's before you. I'll begin by saying that the board either approves or disapproves of the mini bar or retail sale unit hotel room. However, the board went on record 2.5 years ago with a position which prohibited them. They're concerned at that time. They believed that there should be a specific provision in statute and that there wasn't any clear identification of controls related to these kinds of amenities for sales to underage or drunken persons. And for similar reasons, about the same time, the board prohibited sales of alcoholic beverages from vending machines. I guess simply speaking, the bill provides for the self-service retail sale of beverages in hotel rooms to guests within the privacy of those rooms, and occurs in a number of other states, and apparently, as you've already heard, it seems to be somewhat popular for the traveling public. I can't speak for the current board right now. I have sent them copies of the bills, but there are some things that come to mind that, as I said earlier, I'd like to turn your attention. First of all, the whole body of Alaska's liquor law intends that there be sale and service of beverages with contact between a buyer and a seller, where personnel of the licensee exercise control over the sale related to observation of the person to whom they're selling alcoholic beverages. Secondly, there are three issues I think that become significant here. Number one, the bill in its present form moots any hours of sale restrictions contained either in state law or municipal ordinances throughout the state. Additionally, number two, a question certainly I would think would arise related to civil liability for actions against licensees for the sale of probably the unknown sale of alcoholic beverages to underage and drunken persons. And number three, probably with less concern related to the happy hour law, which was adopted 2 or 3 years ago, where a person cannot be served in alcoholic beverages where that person already possesses two or more. Lastly, some other points. The bill does not provide for any request or notice to or review by the board when a licensee desires to provide this kind of service, nor is there any suggestion that a local governing body, the city council or a rural assembly, related to either rural or urban areas of the state, be given some ability to comment on whether or not they desire that kind of service in their community. Additionally, should there be any limitation on the quantities or size of containers or the quality or type of units that would be in service in rooms? I've heard, as Senator Kelly mentioned, the use of mini bottles and the kind of refrigeration units that everyone, I think, is thinking, but in fact, the law does not specify that, and I think the example I used with people here the other day, I believe if you were to implement the law immediately, some unscrupulous licensee would say, I'll put a padlock or a lock on a dresser drawer and fill it with alcohol. I think that's something that should be taken into consideration. And I'll end with a comment I began with, that I certainly don't intend my comments to be perceived as negative, but points that I think that should be taken into consideration. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sharrock. We have a couple of questions. Let me first ask you a couple of questions here. We've got a list of the states that allow these liquor cabinets by statute, and then there's some additional ones that are allowed under regulation. Raises the question that maybe in answer to a couple of the questions you raised, it would seem that by just adding this section into statute, clearly it would fall within your rulemaking scheme to try to address some of those other questions, wouldn't it? Like the extent of the cabinet or something. Wouldn't you already have statutory authorization to promulgate rules to further clarify the kind of broad statutory authority?
Mr. Chairman, yes, you're absolutely correct. The only point I was raising there was that I think that the way the bill is at the present time, when it became effective, I think a licensee, for all intents and purposes, if they wish, could begin to provide that service without any even necessity for contacting the board or anything else.
The other thing is that, as you were describing some of the problems with vis-a-vis the happy hour, vis-a-vis a 2 p.m. closing, and some of these other restrictions we have in the bar situation, I think those are good points if this activity is viewed in the context as quasi-bar activities, and I'm not sure that that's the right analogy. Aren't we really, maybe another analogy to look at it is, aren't we talking about a hotel room being like one's own apartment, and that the booze in the refrigerator there is more akin to you going down to the local liquor store and bringing back a six-pack into your room, where certainly you don't have the same time constraints and some of those other things that you mentioned.
Mr. Chairman, again, I think you're absolutely correct, and I think that's certainly the intent of this whole proposal. I'm just raising caution flags, if you will, related to reference to a specific kind of license and licensee, where under the scheme of the law, there is certainly some responsibility.
I'm going to write it.
And I think, you know, sorry to say, as suit happy as some people are, I think there should be some recognition as to exactly what you're describing. And in effect, the service is there, but it's the same as if a person went to a package store on their own and availed themselves of that service. And responsibility relates only to that guest and not the licensee.
Senator Smansky, did you have a question, Mr. Sherrod?
Thank you. I drafted the bill as part of this International Trade and Tourism Committee. Mr. Schrock, let me first of all indicate that the bill, what some of the comments you made, I think are good observations, but not necessarily appropriate. I mean, when you have to first recognize that we are only granting those beverage dispensing licensed hotel, motel people who have licenses out there. You have already granted them a license to dispense alcoholic beverages. So let me assure you that unless you've granted licenses to people who are not responsible parties, and I assume you don't, then we're assuming most of them have been screened and are fairly responsible parties. With regard to the further review by the board, I don't know of a compelling reason to have a further review of the board, and if you did, you could actually have an endorsement of their existing license, which would say you can dispense, but then you have an endorsement added to your license after review by the board. But I'm not too sure when that's going to get us down the road, because if they are going to comply with the law, they're going to comply with the law, and they're going to tell you that. We'd probably hear more discussion on that. The individual's rights to conduct whatever they want to within their hotel room gets into big-time question associated with rights of privacy under our Constitution, and we're very restricted as to what we can do within their privacy area in their particular interest. Liability, there's no question in my mind that the liability of the dispensing licensee is definitely there at any tier which they make dispense the alcohol. So I think that's something that the hotels, motels, so forth are going to have covered underneath their existing insurance. I'm not as concerned about that. One thing I would like to have you address, and it's something that I had in two drafts of this bill originally, when I questioned our legal people over what, and I don't want to confuse you on this, it's conceivable, I'm told now, that we could run non-alcoholic mini bars in a hotel today, and at the request of a patron, stock that bar when they check in. And that would be legal activity, and they could dispense that at their request. In other words, a person could have a refrigerator with all the non-alcoholic beverages in it, in a refrigerator in their day. When they checked in, they would have a rack of miniatures, which would be given to them to stock in their room. Do you agree with that opinion?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Szymanski, did I hear you correctly when you said that a hotel could stock that kind of a unit with non-alcoholic beverages? Certainly, that's no problem.
And upon request of the individual patron, they could then stock it. In other words, they could make a sale to them at that time.
That's not correct.
Okay, I will provide you a copy of our legal opinion that says, from our drafter, that is currently legal. Because I think I need to clarify that if it is not, because it is conceivable. There's several different ways that these are done. One is having a unlocked, one reason that I had suggested going to an unlocked cabinet or just having a normal refrigerator in a small motel where the cost of putting locks and keys and so forth are not warranted, was just that it would be conceivable that you could dispense it to the individuals who rent the room at that point in time, and you would not have to maintain an elaborate lock and key system. You see there? See what the logic is there?
Partially, maybe. Getting back to where we left off, though, I certainly don't want to challenge the legal opinion you have, other than a beverage dispensary licensee is not licensed to sell alcoholic beverages in their original containers. That privilege relates to a package store licensee. Beverages currently, at least the practice that we have been advising licensees or hotel licensees throughout the state, is that they provide the sale of alcoholic beverages to room service by service of a drink to the guest in the room. Not an unopened bottle of beer, bottle of wine, or what have you.
I will get that opinion to you, and we will certainly have an opportunity, I guess, to try to figure out how you differentiate between the two under current statute. The other comment I was going to make with regard to specifying the characteristics of the bottles, this system is so widely, it's been developed over the years, gets to the point where they've actually got computerized units that are mounted into the wall, where you walk up, push a button, and it dispenses a drink, and it charges the room automatically on the hotel bill. There's a resort in Oregon that I visited that had that type of a system, so that way you don't even deal with the miniatures. It's just, I assume it's built into a bottle that's behind the wall or in the cabinet and does that. Are you familiar with those?
I've seen some, but I'm not familiar with that particular kind of sensor, Andy.
Thank you.
Senator Adams and then Senator Kelly.
Pat, this is Al Adams. My first one is, you're going to be the one that's enforcing the legislation. I note the fiscal note. I assume you're going to do it within the budget.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Adams, I guess realistically speaking, I think it's an unenforceable situation.
Okay, my second question happens to do with the stocking of the alcohol beverages, and I'm looking at the bill there, and I'm looking at lines number 20, and I'm just reading to you, alcohol beverage stocked in this subsection must be stored, and I wanted to add the words, in a refrigerated unit using a key or combination lock system within the guest room. And my reasons are similar to yours, is I think that some of the hotel motels would start utilizing also the dresser drawers for their storage units versus a refrigerated unit. What's your thoughts on that?
Mr. Chairman, I think that, Senator Adams, I think that certainly lends itself to what everyone's impression of what the intent is here, because that's what everyone has mentioned to me in the discussions that we've had around the table here. I think that certainly adds clarification.
Thank you. My last comment is not to you, Mr. Surratt, but, you know, somebody mentioned you need liquor to make a world-class hotel. That is not true. I can take the hotel in my town, the Nulipik Hotel. It doesn't have liquor. It's a world-class hotel. It provides good service. And you don't not necessarily need alcohol in the rooms.
You don't need a TV either there, I guess. Senator Kelly.
Yeah, Pat, I agree with that refrigerated unit. What I have in mind, and I've run into these things several times, would work. I mean, you know, they're handy to have. If I recall right, they might have had 6 cans of beer and 8 miniatures of liquor and a bunch of apples and oranges and sandwiches and soda pop. I don't see a major problem with that. Under the terms of this bill, however, how do we keep this from becoming just another after-hours joint? I mean, would there be provisions where they couldn't stock those units after the regular closing time of the bar? How do we keep it from just becoming a party room when the bar is closed?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kelly, with that question directed to me, this is Pat.
Well, you're the expert. Yeah, I would hope that you might know how the board could keep that sort of thing from happening.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know how the board could prohibit that, and I think that's what I was alluding to earlier, where an unscrupulous operator will set the stage for that very kind of thing happening. As someone mentioned earlier, Senator Porchot, the board certainly has the authority to address the issue, certainly not easily, but by regulation in some form, and I guess that's what I was reaching for in my opening remarks, that I think, and I think the board would prefer that where there is alcohol being sold and distributed, being distributed on a licensed premises, that it should have some review authority of how that takes place.
Mr. Strock is back.
For sure.
I was trying to think about when I've been in hotels that have this, and it seems like one of the things on, I guess you can have disreputable operators, but the ones that I recall, it wasn't like there was a great deal of alcohol in the refrigerator. It seems like there was several beers and several little bottles. I assume that we've had the discussion with the liability. I don't think you're going to remove the hotel's liability for negligent use of any facilities, whether it's the bathroom sink or the bar. And it seems like that probably the amount of alcohol would undoubtedly be limited in the refrigerator, which brings me to the second point here that was raised about the hours. Wouldn't it still be against the rules of the dispensary license to restock a refrigerator after the closing time of the bar?
Mr. Chairman, certainly I think that's a reasonable restriction, if you will, but the legal question, I guess, is that the self-service dispensing of the alcohol from the unit is where the sale takes place. I know we're getting technical here, but say people don't get back to their room until 2 o'clock in the morning, and that's when the hours cease. So then they would begin to serve themselves. That's the issue related to hours. Secondly, getting back to the description of using the mini bottles, that still, as I said earlier, is not particularly or specifically reflected in the bill. Everybody assumes that, but in fact, that isn't what is provided for in the bill. If any kind of alcoholic beverage may be stocked in the room, size unknown.
Well, let's get an answer to the first question. Could a hotel restock an in-room refrigerator after the closing time of their bar?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Well, could the board say, no, you can't do that?
Mr. Chairman, current law says that no person may be beyond a licensed premises after the time for closure other than for licensees and their employees for purposes of preparing for the next day's business, or words, something to that effect. So if a room is vacant, the licensee could certainly stock the room and then rent the room.
Okay, Pat, Tim again. Now what if we made each of these hotels, motels, resorts seek approval of the board prior to doing this? Now doesn't the board, can't they keep this whole thing pretty well straight? If we say notwithstanding any other provision of law, upon approval of the board, a holder of a beverage dispensary license, etc.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kelly, I think that would be very appropriate.
Mr. Strzok, this is Senator Porchot again. On the notwithstanding any other provision of law, that those words always kind of scare me. Can you, in a dry area now or in a damp area, is it possible for someone to be a holder of a beverage dispensary license, even though they may not currently be making sales?
Mr. Chairman, yes, a person may hold a beverage dispensary license. The only limitation is that under the law, they must operate that license no less than 38-hour days during the calendar license year. But the board may waive that requirement, depending on what the representations are for reasons why it wasn't operated.
I guess I'm just concerned that we not waive all other relevant provisions of law, like local option laws, for this particular provision. And I, I'm not sure how those would relate to each other, but what, maybe that's a question for the bill sponsor. What was intended by notwithstanding any other provision of law? Why not just start out with, why not start the sentence, a holder of a beverage dispensary license issued, etc.?
Because as Mr. Sherrock stated, they have the ability to govern or license various types of dispensary, whether it's a package store, whether it's a bar. They've got restaurants that got beer and wine licenses. They've got a multitude of different types of dispensing. The reason that, and in your case you just said local option is an example. In a local option, you'd never be a holder of a beverage dispensing license. You couldn't get one in a closed area.
Well, you could hold one from before.
But a local option law would not, I mean, you could hold one, but you can't use it in one. You'd be violating local law. In other words, what I'm saying is the qualifier to the statute that's before you is that if you're a holder of a beverage dispensing license used to a motel, caterers, traveling, may stock out the beverage. In other words, there's no question in anybody's mind that's the qualifier. You've got to be a licensed premises with operating this type of a license that's in a hotel motel license. And once you got that ticket to ride, then you are extended these privileges. It doesn't say that everybody, then let's say a person that just has a straight bar license, they can't take their straight bar license and take it to somebody's motel and then start using it. See what I'm saying? That's the restriction.
I wonder if what we might do with the concurrence of the sponsor. It seems like we've had several things raised here for refrigerated unit in the room, how the board would be authorized to issue regulations, how to address some of the more obvious questions of restocking after hours. What I'd like to do is perhaps, Mr. Sherrock, if we could work with you between now and tomorrow and Friday to bring back Friday a CS incorporating some of these comments. I see them more as clarifying our intent here and making the thing work. Certainly not, you know, changing the substance of the bill. Senator Sinaskin, do you have any objections to that process?
No, I guess the only thing I'd like to introduce in addition to that would be if we find out that I'd like to also deal with Mr. Sherrock on that question of stocking a non-alcoholic bar. The obvious point there being, if you don't have to go through the expense of modifying or making a room specifically secured and all this stuff, and you can then dispense it as an individual 21 years or older that's legally able to do it, can do it, then we need to maybe put that provision in there as well. But when I ran it by the drafters originally, they said that it wasn't required because current statute provides for it.
Senator Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, I am too nervous about notwithstanding any of the provisions of law, and I would like a board approval on each individual hotel, motel, or resort. Now, I don't think, you know, they're going to hassle it again, but I think that we'll get what we are all thinking that it should be, you know, which is those little units that are convenient for drivers.
So if we set a board door, like a indoor,
upon approval by the board.
Right, the problem is they get an endorsement to their current license.
And then, if they were abusing the situation, the board could repeal your
vote. That'd be good.
Any other suggestions for CS or any other concerns by the members? Mr. Sherrock, thank you very much. We'll be getting back with you. Are you going to be in Anchorage the next day or two? Mr. Sherrock, are you with us?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I wasn't listening. I'm sorry. What was your question?
I just wonder if you're going to be around town in Anchorage the next day or two so we can try to address some of the concerns that you and the members of the committee raised on this bill.
Absolutely, anytime.
Great. Well, we'll set SB 232 aside, and we will try to bring back on Friday a CS incorporating some of these proposed changes and concerns. Senator Smansky, thank you very much. Yeah, why don't you just stay there. The next bill before us is SB 201, dealing with an appropriate. On SB 201, dealing with appropriation for an environmental assessment work on naval home porting. Senator Sinasky?
Thank you. Not on top, I'm sorry.
No, no.
Thank you. I appreciate that the record manager, Senator Mike Sinasky, the sponsor of the Senate Bill 201. There is a CS that's been drafted, and what I'll do is probably just try to keep my remarks short by saying that the home porting issue is one that we're all very familiar with, pretty well self-explanatory. Obviously, the purpose of the legislation is to enable the administration to deal with the Department of Defense and working, actually the Department of Navy, to work out some type of arrangement to evaluate the environmental impact or the impact of both Kodiak and Seward. The modifications or changes that basically made in the CS allow us to take in consideration existing EISs, environmental impact statements, that would be able to possibly shortcut or even substitute for what they've already requested. In the case of Seward, as an example, there's already one that was done, a very substantial one that is available, and in immediate review by the department indicated that that'll probably help them out. With that, I'm sure that the department should have the other comments they'd like to make it.
Senator Ewing and Senator Adams.
Yeah, to the sponsor of this, I guess this we're talking about here specifically an environmental impact statement on that, but there are other costs, I guess, that are associated with them locating here, and maybe you could update me on the discussion on what the costs are in the state and how much we have to come up with. I think I've heard that number bat around, but I just want to get it on the record. And what else is involved besides just this appropriation, because don't we need business go along with even more state participation for it to really actually work?
To be candid with you, no, I don't know what that is, and I think the department's going to have to. The legislature's basically been taken out of the role of participating in this, and this is an administrative function that they're negotiating or dealing directly with the Department of Navy on it, and those discussions of what can or should be reimbursable cost or cost assumed by the state and so forth have just haven't been shared with me.
Senator Adams?
No, my line of question is the same as Ewing. It's the future capital cost, something like this. I presently am, we have none of the time, sorry. I am against a piece of legislation as this, as I'm looking forward for instead is the cleanup of your particular district in the oil spill before I even think of more appropriations for anything like this. The last thing is I don't think Seward or Kodiak should be the home base. If there is going to be one, I think the point of deployment should be down in the Aleutian chain, such as in Dutch Harbor, to get around to various places in Alaska. But at this time, I cannot support a piece of legislation attending the hell of the oil spill. So, and the known factor of capital cost in the future.
If I could respond for the record, again, I appreciate the candid remarks by the Senator Kotzebue. Obviously, neither he or I are qualified naval officers, qualified.
Wait a minute, just for yourself. You're unqualified.
Okay, I'm not qualified to command the fleet operations. They made that decision. The Navy made that decision. And all we're doing is responding to the Navy's interest to locate at these two ports. They went through a fact-finding mission, and from my perspective, they selected based on what their criteria was. Many different elements, but they selected these two ports. What we're attempting to do is respond to the public's best interest to their proposal, which is economically enhancing to both of those facilities if and when it happens.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Kelly,
where did you get the figure $750,000 from?
That figure was pulled out of the air based on, and I say that very candidly, that it was pulled out of the air based on a difference between several opinions. The commissioner's initial reaction was it'd take approximately $1 million. My position was that it was probably take about $250,000. Others suggested it probably cost about $500,000. We kind of split the difference, and maybe we've got a more refined position now by the administration here today.
Why don't we hear from Mr. Stolfus from the Department of Transportation. I think you've heard some of the concerns. I too wanted to hear more in the way of background as far as what DOT's relationship is to the Navy, what part of the total EIS process that the DOT would be doing, how much money that the Navy is putting forward to not only this initial effort, but also the capital project effort that might follow.
For the record, my name is Clyde Stelzfus. I'm the Special Systems Commissioner of DOT. I'll try to respond to all your questions. If I miss some of them, please refresh my memory. First of all, Senator Ewling, as to your cost estimates requirements, the initial cost estimates for Kodiak were $105 million and for Seward were $104 million, including housing. There's a lot of different ways to skin the cat with the capital costs. A lot of the ideas that have been bandied around are some financing by the local community. Certainly lease payments by the Navy has been one of the discussion points. I think it would be fair to say as regard to the capital costs that no one really knows how that will all play out. We're in the middle of negotiations, we're in the middle of really just beginning the process. So it's real difficult to say what the state's outlay for capital projects will be in the future for this project. Suffice it to say, though, the Senate Joint Resolution 55 makes it very clear that the legislature at the time of the passage of Senate Joint Resolution 55 was not interested in the Navy homeporting unless there was a benefit to the state. And we've taken that very seriously to mean that there had to be some kind of payback to the state if they were going to invest capital investments in homeporting. And that continues to be the administration's guiding light. With regard to the relationship of the department to the Navy, that also is just developing. We've had initial contacts with Admiral Pyatt from the Secretary's office. We've had some discussions back and forth, but there's been very little dialogue as far as the details of this project and how the Navy and the state would relate over the term of this project. One of the items that is included in the expenditures that are listed in Senate Bill 201 is the preparation of a memorandum of understanding with the Navy to try and lay our roles out in an understanding before we get too far along in this project. So that, again, is something that's just developing, and we'll know more about that in the near future.
Senator Kelly, Senator Adams?
The cost. Have you got a more refined figure than a swag? Wild-ass guess of $750,000?
We tried to look at these figures to see how we would use this money if it were appropriated. First of all, we don't think that even the $750,000 would cover the full list of items that are listed in section two of the bill. As Senator Szymanski alluded to previously, we have figured about $1 million to do an EIS for the two communities. This not only covers an EIS, it also covers negotiating with the Navy for the project. So it involves quite a bit of personnel time and travel time.
You mean you're going to hire new people to do that?
We have no intention to do that. We're using
existing. Well, we're not so busy over here. They're all booked up, aren't they?
The people that we've, Senator Kelly, the people that we've used to date on this project have been capital improvement people, and we've been in charge of the project.
Do you have a table? I'm sorry. Yeah, Senator Kelly.
I have another question. I support this project to a certain extent. That extent is that we have to have a commitment from the Navy. They're going to be here long enough to repay any capital investment we put in. Ships can sink. Ships can go to the Middle East and never come back. We're in kind of a tough position if we have a naval base, and the only two potentials are the U.S. Navy and the Soviet Navy. We're going to be rather embarrassed if we're negotiating with the Soviets to use our base, right? So, from my point of view, we have to have some kind of a lease provision where the Navy is obligated to pay over a 20 or 30 year period. And, my support down the line is going to be contingent on that.
Senator Kelly, that was our intention to include a provision such as that in the memorandum of understanding that would, one, either indemnify us if they would move out before. Our intention is to get lease payments to get a payback on the capital improvements. And also, if they should pull out before the lease payments have paid back the capital improvements, to have indemnifications and clause in there, so that the state just pulled back their investment they had, excuse me, paid back.
Senator Adams, and then Senator Ewing.
Same line of questioning is DOT's position on this particular piece of legislation is only when you have a provision to recover the capital cost on the project. When is the timeline to get this knowledge from the Navy?
We would only proceed with the environmental impact statement after we have such an agreement in place.
When would that take place?
We'd like to do that this summer.
So basically, you don't need this piece of legislation right now.
Well, we'd like to start the environmental impact statement as soon as we have the memorandum of understanding signed. And we would like to have the memorandum of understanding signed by the beginning of the summer.
Mr. Chairman, do we have an effective date in here that the money only takes place after the memorandum of understanding is?
No, as a matter of fact, that was one of my great. We have this good language on memorandum of understanding. Unfortunately, it's just number five in the findings. It's not tied to the appropriation.
Well, at a minimum, I don't think the appropriation should take effect until after the memorandum of understanding is signed.
Senator Ewing, not to cut.
Well, yeah, I'm just trying to get, I know we talked about the $2 amounts of the Seward and the Kodiak, $105 million. I just want to think and see if we're putting the cart before the horse. I would assume that, that there's, number one, a necessity to have state participation and to make it work, having the governor and the administration, number one, two, behind it, and then along with that, the environmental impact statement is a part of that to make it all work. But I need some clarification on the memorandum. What are we essentially doing all this work out there before we really have the A-OK to go with? What are we going to actually build it?
No.
So then why are we doing an environmental impact statement?
We're only going to do the environmental impact statement would proceed building, of course.
Right.
But the memorandum, I guess maybe I need to clarify the steps that we would proceed. First of all, we have a memorandum of understanding, which would outline the project, outline the participation of both parties in the project, and then outline the obligations of the parties should things fall apart, should things not come to fruition. And then the environmental impact statement would follow that. And then the construction would follow that.
Okay, but don't we need a commitment from the state of Alaska and a commitment from the Navy that they're actually going to go through it and they're going to do it?
We would only need a commitment, and as far as we are concerned, we would only need a commitment from the Navy to pay back for any of the money that we've expended in trying to get the project together prior to completion of the EIS, because we wouldn't commit to building the project until after the EIS.
I see. So, Mr. Chairman, so the EIS is something that is a necessity to do before there's any dollars that are actually put into it.
That's correct.
Okay, and how long do you perceive it'll take to do the EIS?
Yes, it could take as long as 2 years, depending on various. Senator Schmansky alluded to a document that was produced for Seward that was actually an environmental assessment, which is not quite as detailed as an environmental impact statement. And so there would be some shortcoming for Seward because of the environmental assessment that's already been completed, but it would still have to go through a fairly lengthy process.
What's the how much additional money beyond what you have in existing DOT capacity is required for just the negotiation of the memorandum of understanding or agreement?
Yeah, I wouldn't want to hazard a guess on that right now, Mr. Chairman.
See, I'm even more cautious than Senator Kelly is on this. I would foresee a situation that you all may not agree with their participation in the EIS process. Maybe they're looking for 100%. Reimbursement or charge back on. I assume they have the responsibility to do an environmental assessment sometimes.
As I understand it.
Yeah. And I've been involved in environmental assessment projects before where we build beeping standards for the entire cost of the EIS done by a federal agency. That may be their thinking of this, that we are. The state of Alaska, they're doing it for our benefit and they're billing back their entire cost. That wouldn't be what I would want to get into, and I doubt if that's what state DOT certainly would be I guess I'm looking for you. My vision as it would be that we are responsible for perhaps little pieces of EIS, but they have a substantial, you know, financial and manpower obligation for the pulling together different elements and then pulling together all the elements into the EIS and all the review process and that goes into that. Is that the DOT's vision of this?
There's been some debate exactly, Mr. Chairman, there's been some debate exactly what the Navy can do or can allow someone else to do for them in an EIS statement. And that's not clear in my mind exactly how that can be farmed out between the state and the Navy.
Well, it doesn't necessarily have to be the work farmed out, but it could still require billing of being paid by the state for other work that they contract on, conceivably.
I guess I'm not sure what you're saying.
It may not be the state doing the work. Maybe they need to do a socioeconomic portion of their environmental statement. They contract it out, but they bill the state back for that work, for part of the EIS work.
Mr. Chairman, I think that they would like to do that. That's part of the reason for that, what I'm not saying, is to try to figure out who is responsible for all the different elements.
Yeah. But I want to know what DOT's position is going into those. I mean, is it your position that we, the state, would probably pick up most, if not all, of the costs of the environmental statement?
Our position going in is that we would pick up no more than 50%.
That's what I wanted to do.
I think that's the key to it, Mr. Chairman, that first of all, you have to determine what the participation is going to be by the federal government and the state of Alaska. If it's 50%, that's fine. And then there should be some analysis from DOT on what the costs of that are going to be to it.
I guess conclusion of my remarks is I'm not sure it takes $750,000 to just proceed to the point that we all want to go before we put forward another dime. And I could see truncating the whole process if we don't agree with the Navy on what a reasonable level of involvement would be in essentially a planning process. I mean, this is not even getting to the capital funding stage. Mr. Chairman, tell me.
$500,000 from us, $500,000 from the Navy, that's $1 million that gets it done.
Well, this would be the approach similar to what, for example, we took in the case of the feasibility study on the Rogner venture with ADA. And it seems to be not unreasonable, assuming we want to move forward with at least investigating.
Yeah, and I might add that, you know, as much as we wanted that project out in our district, when that feasibility project came back negative, we all backed off. We listen to the feasibility.
Other questions of the department? I think we have, thank you, Clyde. Karen Brewster?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Karen Brewster. I'm with the Alaska Environmental Lobby. And I'm just going to read a statement that Bill Glue wrote up that he's the one who knows more about this issue and was unable to be here. He's in the finance committee meeting. And so if anybody has any questions, I'm not quite sure I'll be able to answer them, but I'll take them down and have somebody get back to me. While we agree that an environmental impact statement, including socioeconomic evaluation, is an absolute necessity required to serious consideration of Navy input in Alaska, the Alaska Environmental Lobby cannot support SB 201. Since significant and adverse impacts of home porting are readily apparent, it is highly inappropriate for the state to advance public funds toward that end. The Navy must provide its own study and pay its own way. The state of Alaska is in no position to buy jobs, particularly when we are looking at an activity which brings highly toxic plutonium, nuclear weapons, burdens to public facilities, and a very poor environmental record into our communities. We would prefer to see our limited state funds go to supporting necessary basic services, assisting our independence from oil revenue, and dealing with such urgent matters as oil spill prevention and cleanup.
Ms. Brewster, thank you very much.
Thank you.
What I would be interested in doing here, and frankly, I still have a desire to hear from someone from the Navy on this, and at least for no other reason than to try to ask them for what their current resources are or what they're asking for in the FY 90 budget for pursuing this kind of planning effort that's needed. What I'd like to do is try to hook up somebody in teleconference on Friday to see if we can talk to them. And at the same time, I'd suggest that perhaps we pursue the suggestions by Senator Kelly and others on the committee to redraft 201 working with the sponsor in such a manner that it's more contingent on a couple of things. One would be the signing of, you know, working towards and signing a memorandum of understanding or agreement, and the second would be to ensure some sort of cost sharing with the Navy on this. Is Chairman? Senator Kelly?
If you can't get anybody in the Navy director, you might get a hold of Ted Stevens' office and see who they might recommend, because they've been closely involved.
If there's no other comments or questions on 201, we would like to turn to HB 73.
I wonder why Sal is here.
I don't see Bob Stalnecker, but I do see
great.
Please, Ms. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Sally Smith, Director of the Division of Retirement and Benefits. Hospice 73 is purely a technical bill, clearing up problems with three bills that passed during 1988. The first problem was in legislation from the Department of Revenue. Inadvertently, language was omitted in their technical correction or technical bills last year that removed language saying that the interest and capital from investments in TRS would revert back to the fund. This just authorizes that those monies will go back into teachers' retirement system funds. This is not to say that it's not being done now, but just to protect against any future possibilities. The second item is a correction to legislation that related to levy of funds on the elected public officials and the judicial retirement system funding. Those accruals in the retirement systems can be levied. A levy must be in full, it can't be partial. This particular bill allowed for the repayment of those levies against those monies, but language was left in that referred the repayment in the judicial retirement system back to a subsection A that was not named in the bill. Subsection A required that those monies be paid back within 1 year, regardless of whether or not the judge returned back to full-time employment. The other legislation, the rest of the legislation requires or says that if you do not return back to service, you can repay that indebtedness up until the time that you take retirement. So this would simply correct that to allow the judges parity with the other systems. The third one is the changes that were made to the supplemental benefit system annuity program in compliance with federal requirements. And inadvertently, it says the department shall pay the employer contributions. That's certainly fine when the department is the employer, but conceivably, a political subdivision could require the state to pay their employer contributions. We would like to see that language changed to employer.
Chairman, my only question, I guess, is on the judges and the justices. How does it pertain, like, to the PERS and the TERS now? In other words, if someone is vested with their 5 years, can they have to take money out of their retirement account for emergency before they retire? Can they, and let's say they put that back in at any time, they can do so, can they not?
That's correct.
And what happened was that this was inadvertently left out for the judges and justices, so now that they will be put on the same equal basis as all PERS and TERS.
That's correct.
Does the justice and the judges and justices, do they fall under the PERS program, or do they fall under a judicial, a special judicial retirement program?
Mr. Chair, through you to Senator Ewing, they have their own retirement system. The judicial retirement system is one of the five.
So it's like jurors or something?
Correct.
Other questions? I certainly view this as a technical bill. What is the desire of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I would move and ask you to consent the bill be passed out with individual recommendations.
Without objection, House Bill number 73 moves from committee with individual recommendations. Last, Mr. Barker, HB 74. This was a bill that was up where when we last left it, we wanted to make sure that we were not giving somebody some windfall through this process and had requested from the department a little more backup. Hopefully, there you should have this sheet in front of you. Mr. Barker, I wonder if you could just walk us very quickly through the existing and proposed situation.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, my name is Mel Barker, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue. This would refinance essentially an existing obligation issued by the developer of the Seward Student Service Center, Dick Fisher, and the interest rate on the current obligation is 7.33%, essentially. The fiscal analysis that was done last fall when this was prepared assumed 6.75%, which would have produced a present value savings of $1.2 million, actual dollar savings of $1.7 million. Now, since then, interest rates have risen up to fairly close to the interest rate on the existing debt. They might be about 7.25% if we did issue this debt today. So at this point, the savings would be significantly diminished. We would request it is that the legislation be enacted, though, so that the authorization would be in place when interest rates drop down 0.5% or so to make the financing as attractive as it was last fall. That's not very much change in interest rates to make a pretty big difference here in the percentage savings.
Mr. Parker, if I might just interrupt just for a second. What, in the absence of, this legislation, what are the other authorities that you would be going under to make the decision to refinance? Are you bound by other prescriptions or other guidelines in making your decision on whether to refinance?
Well, the decision actually is controlled by the Department of Administration. They would have to execute the lease with the State Building Authority, which would provide the source of funding for the Building Authority's debt. So it would really be up to John Andrews is to finally yay or nay when and if this were to be done.
Can we just safely assume that he would not make the decision if he wasn't going to save any money?
Oh, I'm sure he would do it if he weren't going to save money. And in fact, as indicated in the memo, the State Bond Committee, which would, as a practical matter, be involved in the decision making, is required at least a 3% savings before proceeding with the refinancing.
That's really what I was wanting assurances.
Right. I would expect this probably not be done until the savings were even in excess of that. And they might even be at this time. I didn't have sufficient opportunity to redo the analysis, but aside from the savings due to the decline in interest rate, there is essentially a reserve fund backing the existing debt that would refer to the state upon extinguishment of that existing debt. And that amount that would come back to us would be almost $400,000. Now, that would, you would, I guess, have to have financing. That in and of itself would represent about 7.5% savings right there on the amount of financing if we're in the neighborhood of about $6 million, which is probably what it would be. So, I think the savings are there to proceed even with interest rates at current levels, but we would probably, as indicated in the memo, given that the interest rate environment may be around its peak, we probably would maybe consider deferring this for a year and that interest rates might be reduced by 1990.
Could you speak then to the rental payments vis-a-vis the debt service and the role of the reserve there?
I'm sorry.
Could you speak to the current rental payments and how they relate to the debt service payment and the reserve fund?
Yes, sir. The on the first page, the anticipated rent is what we would pay to under this refinancing. The second column shows you the existing rent, and the third column is indicated, shows the total dollar savings of $1.7 million, present value of that is $1.2 million. As indicated in the year 1990 under savings, we get a big chunk of change back there. That is essentially the rebate of this reserve fund that backs the existing debt. On the next page, you see we have an option to purchase every July through the term of the existing debt and at various prices. Those prices decline each year, more or less in step with the amount of debt outstanding shown in the second set of figures on page two. Essentially see that by the last year, 1999, the amount of the purchase price is roughly that of the certificates that are outstanding. Now that's of some interest because in the current year, for example, you can see that the purchase price is about $5 million, while the certificates are outstanding are $6 million, with the lessor actually having to pay a bit more than that because of the 2% premium on redemption, 102% redemption price. So he would pay over $6 million to redeem the debt, which is something he has to do if we exercise a purchase option. It is our option, and we have the sole right to decide whether or not to exercise that. So anyway, he has to come up with about $1 million difference over what we're going to pay him, and essentially that comes out of the reserve fund. So you can see that as long as he can put off the exercise of the purchase option, there's going to be more of the reserve fund left. Now, at some point, some of that's going to start winding up in his hands if we were to exercise our option. During the next few years, upon the exercise of the option, an amount is rebated to the state that is an amount not to exceed our annual rental payment, essentially. And the amount of cash that the lessor has on deposit to make that rebate to the state, as well as the difference between the purchase price and debt outstanding, is $815,000 in the reserve fund and the rental payment of about $800,000. That rental payment is sitting there for half a year before it has to be paid for debt service. So he has about $1.6 million during the first half of each fiscal year is sitting there in cash. And our exercise of the purchase option would eventually be priced close enough to the debt that he would be able to both make the rebate to us of up to $800,000, our payment, our rental payment, and also pay off the debt, and yet still have most of the reserve fund sitting there, which would then go to the developer or the lessor. So I suspect the lessor would not like to consummate this transaction any sooner than necessary. If anything, the state's going to get a windfall from the reserve fund the earlier we do this. The earlier we do it, the bigger our recapture of that reserve fund.
And then currently the rent payments do not equal the debt service, so that there's no...
The rent payments do go to debt service.
But they don't cover the debt service now, at this time.
Well, they're made on June 10th. The date for the payment on debt service is January 1st, so we pay in advance over 6 months. And it's sitting there for that first half of the year. We exercise a purchase option. That occurs in July while that rent payment's still sitting there. So essentially, that comes back to us. And if the reserve fund's needed to pay off the debt, then it is used for that purpose. But if it's not, it may wind up in the hands of the lessor, more so the longer this is deferred. Fairly complex, I apologize for it.
This is exactly what I was hoping to get. No, thanks. This, okay. I think, is actually pretty clear on.
I might just address one other question that was raised. According to the Department of Administration, Dick Fisher Development Incorporated was selected as the developer and lessor for this project by a competitive bid, ready sealed bid. He had the low bid apparently.
Questions, Mr. Parker?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I assume what this is then, as soon as what we would do is we would essentially refinance the whole thing.
Correct.
So, I mean, then we get into the lease purchase question, whether that's, who's paying for that, the fact that it's not, you know, going out to people for the vote and everything, then we've got that issue for the legislature before. Did this come up before, did we have a bill like this last year?
What bill?
Did we have a bill similar to this that was in the last? What happened to the bill?
This was in a proposal that also contained the master lease financing bill and the ASVA lease financing consolidation from an organization standpoint. And frankly, it never got out of first committee because it was just too much for people to bite off in one hunk, I think. It just got lost in the shuffle.
Even some of those pieces are still creating problems again this year, and they're separate pieces.
We separated them this year so that they could receive attention to allow some of it to move forward.
Mr. Chairman, I know that this is, you know, there's a lot involved here. We need, you know, I know it's got a finance before we take a look at it under the finance. You want to eventually move it up there. I don't, you probably want to do some more time, or you want
no,
to,
I,
do you want to pass it out?
Absolutely. This was exactly what we were looking for, and I'm very comfortable with the bill.
Okay, Mr. Chairman?
Yep, Senator Adams.
I move and ask unanimous consent that committee substitute for Senate bill, House Bill number 74 finance be moved out of committee with individual recommendations.
Any objections? If not, House Bill 74, CS, moves from committee. Oh, no. It's the House CS. Yeah.
Should go to the finance committee.
Yes.
Well, there's so much discussion about lease purchases. Come on.
Do you want to adjourn the meeting? Oh, yeah.
Oh, adjourn.
Under this proposal.